born in Russia, came over to the States when she was about 11 years
old.
Do
you know what part of Russia?
My sister knows exactly. We're still trying to trace that. Alice is still trying to trace that, to be specific. She came over when she was about 14 and with her mother, her sister, and her brother. And they came to the East where they met, apparently she met my father when she was young, where he was born in New Jersey. Where they met, I'm not sure. But then her family came to the West Coast, and then my father wanted to see her again, so he moved to the West Coast. This is the story I got. And lived with his brother, who was old enough to be his father, because he was from a very large family. He was the youngest of something like 12. And he lived with his brother and courted my mother on the West Coast when they got married and where they got married. And my father did various and sundry things, which I could fill in later, but right now I can't remember all the details, some of which he played professional baseball at one time. My mother became a housewife and mother and did some sewing on the side. And we lived in various places on the east side of Los Angeles. I was the fifth of seven children. My sister Selma being the eldest, and my brother Eddie, my sister Millie, my brother George, myself, Louise, my brother Lenny, and my sister Jackie, in that order, girl, boy, all the way down. I remember starting kindergarten at Bridge Street School. It was very traumatic. I don't know why my mother had to drag me to school. I was scared. These are some early memories. And I remember my brother Lenny was still a baby at that time. And let's see, what else?
What do you remember about the area in which you grew up?
We lived in several different places. The first was East L.A., and it was fine. It was mixed ethnic groups, mostly Russian background, Russian Jewish background. Then there were Mexicans and Greeks. Not that many blacks, as I remember. We all played together, but we were still groupy as far as our religious backgrounds. And we lived across the street from a playground where we used to play, my whole family. And we had a big house, big old house. And we moved quite often. And so when you say I remember we lived in a kind of a duplex or triplex when I went to first started school. And then I remember we lived in a big house when I was about 8 years old. I remember having a terrible toothache while my mother was nursing my sister, and she was very upset. Very early memory of how upset she was that she was not up and about enough to take me to the dentist, and it was very traumatic for her. And for me, it didn't bother me, except that I remember my cheek was swollen, and someone took me to the dentist because I had a tooth pulled. And I went through grammar school on the east side of Los Angeles. Remember Sheridan Grammar School. Then I went to Hollenbeck Junior High. When I started Roosevelt High School, we really didn't have we walked long distances to school. Everything was fine. We went, I know my family were, I didn't know how poor we were or if we were poor because we always had, I mean, I know now that we weren't well off, but everybody was in that situation. Everybody had financial problems, and we all, we lived pretty comfortably. We had good food, so we never that worried. But I know that my mother, as I think back, my father, were always careful about expenditures and could they afford this and that. And I also remember on Winter Street, where we lived, how that our rent was something like $30 a month. And we walked long distances to school. And had, most of our friends were on the block. We played a lot of games in the streets, kicked the can and all these things. And I went. We moved to San Diego when I was in high school because my father's his business had, my father had been working there and coming up on weekends to Los Angeles. We lived, I think, on Malabar at that time. And my mother was fed up with having him come up like that, so we moved to San Diego. They bought a house in the outskirts. They bought it was a sweet little house way out, and I remember taking the bus into high school every day, and that's where I actually graduated high school, San Diego High School, although all my friends were in L.A. My mother was willing to stay in Los Angeles till I finished high school because she felt I'd want to be with my class, but I urged her to move earlier because I felt I needed to make some contacts and friends while I was still in high school. That was my conscious thinking at the time. And went to high school there and finished. Started to go to San Diego State, and war broke out in 1941. I was going to school. My brother was, George was in the Air Force. And my brother Eddie went into the Navy. I was going to college at the time, San Diego State, and they were very anxious to get workers. They were recruiting workers for industry, and the airplane industry consolidated. Everybody was going into that. I was trying to get an education and at the same time had a lot of guilt about not working for the war effort. So when they came to school and they were asking, there were different people who were trying to recruit students, and they came to my school, and since I was studying to be a social worker, head of a social agency, USO Travelers Aid Society, came to my classroom and talked to the teachers, and the teacher made an announcement about any students that were studying these courses would be given credit if they wanted to take a job with the social agency because everybody was doing war effort work and they needed social workers. And so I felt that was a good way out for me to both work and earn and feel as if I was doing a filling in a job for someone that could be released for other work. And that's what I did. I was getting college credit and went to work for Travelers Aid Society when I was very young. I was about 18 at the time. And had less than 2 years in school and college, but they were giving me credit. And eventually, this agency, Travelers Aid Society, when I was about 21, offered me a scholarship to go to USC and finish when I was about to leave at that time I had wanted to travel and applied for foreign service work. I have to stop and think. Okay, just to go back a little bit, in 1944, when I was 19 years old and working for Travelers Aid Society, my sister Selma, who was 27 years old, died of a kidney infection. This was the most traumatic thing that had ever happened to me, and it really made me think an awful lot about priorities. And I know that she, at that time, she left a two-year-old little girl, Phyllis, and it was so tragic to us because of how we fought to keep my sister alive and what a shock it was to lose someone of that age, even though the war had been going on and taking its toll. This hit us right at home, and then also my brother George was in the service, ready to go overseas, and shook up my family. I decided then that I was going to try and get enrich my life with travel, and I had no other way of doing it other than to apply to the Foreign Service, United States government, for a job, and this was when I was about 21, just getting to be 21. And at that time, my brother George was missing in action, or just before that time. And we found out later, thank God, that he was alive and in a prisoner of war camp in Germany. When he came back from the war, having been through hell, really, but thank God he had been alive and he was back with us. He got married, and then I felt relieved and was able to accept a job with the after an interview. Well, let's go back. I was really too young to be sent overseas. At the same time, they might have made a little mistake in my age, because when they had sent an interviewer to San Diego, who met me at one of the temporary offices, I was interviewed and I was tested. I had IQ tests, etc., and several interviews. Then they investigated my background and all my references, and I was accepted for a position unknown. But they offered me a job in Japan right as soon as the war ended. And my family were very shook up about it. My brother George was still in uniform. He was a captain, Air Force pilot, and came from San Francisco to try and talk me out of it, and kind of said, you know, scared me a little bit about the dangers of going abroad and being a young girl, and et cetera, but I really wasn't frightened. I was determined to go, because I also had a girlfriend that was doing the same thing, or I had met a girl who was going to do the same thing. And wait a minute, no, I think I met her later. But I wasn't frightened for some reason, and decided to go. And left in to my family's dismay. I went, even though they gave me their blessings, but they were fighting it all the way. When I go in 1946, I left in September of 1946 by train to Seattle. I had had some. We had a lot of orientation and different classes. Lots of people were assigned jobs while in Seattle before we left by boat for Tokyo, Yokohama, actually. I hadn't had an assignment. I was supposed to report to the personnel in Tokyo and then was going to be assigned. So this is what happened. We took the boat to land in Yokohama, went by train to Tokyo, where it was, we were, everybody was, all the civilians were called civilians. There was the army, there was the civilians. Can I turn off the tongue-tied? I haven't. Okay, all civilians that were going to work in Tokyo, I was amongst the second wave of civilians, and I think I was the youngest civilian because their minimum age was 25 and I was really just 21. And all of them were called clerks, so we had no designation except I didn't have a designation. Everybody else had a job assignment. When I got to Tokyo, I was housed at the Osaka Hotel with the other civilians, which is a very nice hotel, very close to General MacArthur's headquarters and all-women's hotel, and very close to the main headquarters where he worked and his personnel at the Daiichi building. And we all had... The men civilian had their hotel, and the women civilians had theirs. And I had a nice little room there. They had a lovely dining room. We were not allowed to eat outside of our own hotels because of the food situation in Japan and because of the not only the scarcity of it, but the disease. Infection, etc. So this kept us pretty secure. Anyway, after I was housed a day or two later, reported to the personnel office, and they had indeed had something for me to do, and I was assigned to two British officers, Captain Nicholson and Major Nicholson and Captain Newington, who were assigned to Tokyo by Mountbatten, actually, to on a special mission to interrogate high-ranking Japanese officers, and they were trying to piece together, they were working for British intelligence, trying to piece together the history of the war, of the Japanese participation in the war in a certain area. And they needed, they were under the American intelligence auspices, which means, and using American facilities, which means they had to have an American with them to justify their being in being under American protection, etc. So I was assigned to them. I didn't know what I did for them or what I had to do, but I learned later they both spoke fluent Japanese. They were very, very brilliant young men. They were in their early 20s, just a year or two older than I was, spoke fluent Japanese, and that was their job. They had high-ranking Japanese officers who were in prison awaiting sentences, and they were brought from their prison to our office with all kinds of interpreters and sat at a round table where I just sat and took in a lot of interesting things. And they were interrogated tried to piece the war together. Specifically, at the time, everything was top secret. I couldn't have even discussed this then, but they were trying to find out how much, what the Japanese, how advanced they were in chemical and chemical warfare, and can I turn this off for a second?
Sure.
speed it up. This is fascinating for me, though, because we had all these high-ranking officers who, many of them were later executed for their war crimes, but most of them did speak fluent English, though they would disguise it, because they wanted to our people to go through all the trouble of interrogating them in Japanese and then having it translated. And these two, my two bosses, became very dear friends eventually, and I eventually saw one in England visiting them, and the other one, who was very small, Alfred Newington, married from a very fine English family, Von Newington, actually, married a Japanese girl from a nice family, and he was in, had a lot of problems because he wasn't allowed to marry someone from that country, but he eventually went to work for the Belgian embassy in a non-sensitive capacity. But we were very good friends, and I kept letters from them, because when his wife had a baby, I was able to get her some baby things from our PX, and later on they did fine after the war, etc., after the peace and after the settlement. But when their mission was over, I went on to work for a department of the Army area where they were interrogating prisoners of war from our prisoners and Japanese prisoners that were held for a long time after the war, and brought back to, wait, let me think of this. Can I turn it off for a second? I was just saying to you, Harold, that reminds me of today when we see the Manchurian candidate, that they used to keep, they kept prisoners behind, and there was a lot of brainwashing. They would filter them back in Japan. Even Japanese people were kept behind, but a lot of Americans. And
kept behind by whom?
By the Japanese.
Okay.
Then we would, our department of the Army Intelligence Division would interrogate them and see how much they had been brainwashed by the communists that had a great deal of influence in the Japanese at that time. In Japan at that time, there were a lot of uprisings. Now, the Japanese worshipped Japan. They worshipped MacArthur like they worshipped their king, because we won the war, so he became the person they worshipped next to their king. And that was very interesting, because they'd bow and scrape around them, around MacArthur's headquarters. And during this time, I had a very active social life. I mean, there was something always happening, either with the Americans or with the British. And there were parties, there were lunches, there were breakfasts every day and every night, and trips. I took many trips, side trips to different parts of Japan and Mount Fuji for skiing. And I had a marvelous social life that is only out of a fairy tale, because there was nothing, there was no time for anything else but going and doing and working. And eventually I worked for, when this job was over, I worked as an editor with Natural Resources, where they were working on a land reform bill, and it was so interesting because our biggest enemy at that time was communist Russia, and they had a great deal of influence. They were trying to wield a lot of power in restructuring Japan, and wanted it to be done very much like the Russian land reform. And they called it a democracy, but it wasn't, because they weren't. America wanted to give the land back to the tenant farmers, and they didn't want it that way. And there were a lot of problems in that area. And it was very interesting for me.
That's surprising because I wasn't aware that the Russians had any influence in the sort of reconstruction of Japan.
Yeah, they had a great deal of influence, and this is where there was a lot of holding. The Russians held Japanese prisoners too, brainwashed them. And we were trying to give them. They were calling it democracy. We were calling it communism. They used to threaten the tenant farmers, etc. There were a lot of trouble with the communists. There was a lot of trouble with the communists in Japan after the war. And this was our biggest problem there. When I went to, I went on a trip to Korea through my work with the land reform, natural resources. I had a brief trip there for about a week, and I had known a young doctor by the name of Gerald Evans, I had met in San Diego. In fact, he gave me my shots in San Diego, and he was stationed in Seoul, Korea, and he was the physician to the commanding general there. And when he knew I was coming, we'd corresponded. When he knew I was coming, he met me at the airport and blah, blah, blah. And we had a very lovely, while I was working there for only a week, we had a lovely visit and a semi-romance, in which we talked about getting married. And that was, we were going to talk about it further. I had to go back to Tokyo. And when I went back to Tokyo, a week or two later, I became very ill, and I came down with what later became known as hepatitis. I didn't know what it was. I was fainting and was ill and nauseous. And they had to send the army doctor to my quarters and took me out in a stretcher. I was in terrible pain. And put in the hospital at in 49th General Hospital. I had a girlfriend, Cora Wright, who came to Japan as a social worker for the Red Cross when I did, and a lot of my social life was with her and with a lot of the physicians at the hospital. And when I got in, when I was ill there, I had a lot of attention because of her and because of the physicians that I knew and many I had dated. And Cora was still there. I could go, there are certain personal things I could go back, which I'll tell you later, Harold, if you want to incorporate them, you can. But anyway, I was flat on my back for almost 2 months in the hospital because that was the treatment for hepatitis. You couldn't move. You had to have a lot of sugar to cleanse your liver. And at this time, my doctor was Isaac Newton Lindner, nice Jewish boy from Brooklyn, who was a captain in the armed forces, and he was my physician. And I got very good attention because he had a crush on me. So I had the best attention you could have. And in fact, he kept me in the hospital longer than I should have been. But in the meantime, I was corresponding with Jerry Evans, who was also Jewish in Korea. And since we were separated by miles and by the fact that we couldn't really see each other and continue any kind of a courtship because of his work and where I was that sort of petered out. And although he sent one of his associates to come and see me while I was in the hospital, but that was just a nice visit. And when I got out of the hospital, I was released on the agreement that I would, the first social outing I had was with Newton Lindner. And that started a romance. And between then and the time I came back to the States, because my my contract was over and I did not want to renew it. And his tour of duty in the Army, his obligation was over. He wanted to go back and get his internal medicine training over in New York. And he arranged to be on the same boat that I was on coming back, so we were able to get to know each other better. And I went to L.A., he went to New York, and we continued our romance by mail and by phone, and eventually became engaged. And from then on, I went to New York and stayed. First I went to Washington, and I went to New York, then I went to Washington because my cousin was getting married, and I was going to be the maid of honor. And between New York, where I stayed with my relatives, and he was, Newton's family lived very near, in Brooklyn, we saw each other a lot, got engaged. I went to Washington to my niece's, to my cousin's wedding, corresponded a lot, and something happened at that time. I think I got very scared about living in New York and all these things, and I can't tell you exactly, it wasn't an argument or anything, but we just decided to back off a little bit, give it more time, and I think both of us were relieved because I really didn't feel ready. Although we had had an engagement party, it was very embarrassing. It just didn't work out. He was a very nice man, very nice person, and I didn't, after we had a little correspondence, I didn't hear anything about him or from him for about between 17 and 20 years later. I'm not sure, but I'll tell you about that later. Anyway, in the meantime, I went back to Los Angeles and always went to school, always studied something at night, or always was kept busy deciding what to do in the way of getting a job or going back to school or whatnot. When I got a call from Washington, D.C. asking me if I would like to take a job behind the Iron Curtain. It sounded very exciting to me, and I accepted. Was sent to Washington, D.C., and went to school at the Pentagon to work for the... I was designated to go to Budapest, Hungary, working for the attaché and the embassy legation at the time. And went to Washington to go to school for a couple of months, stayed with my relatives, the Kasnets, my cousin Henry and Edna, Bobby, who was studying to be a dentist, and had a wonderful family life there while I was going to school with the Pentagon, called Counterintelligence School, in which I was supposed to learn a lot of important things about the work, but even took a class in coding, and then also was supposed to learn a little Hungarian, and was about to embark on some Hungarian classes in Hungarian, which I wasn't very suited for because it was such a strange language, when a major uprising occurred in Hungary, and our attaché there, Colonel Kovacs was his name, had to leave the country, shooting his way out because he was being cornered as a spy, which really wasn't true. He was just he was just working in the embassy, as most attachés do. They do gather intelligence for their own country. It's a well-known fact. He had to shoot his way out of the country, and so the whole embassy was in an uproar. And so I had to cut brief my training that I was about to embark on a language class, and they gave me about 30 records and sent me off to Budapest, which was a another fascinating experience. Can I turn this off? I should get my dates straight here. But anyway, I went to Budapest, I think in 49 it was, and worked with the military attaché, processed a lot of reports. Attachés and military attachés and the embassies in every country are designed to look out for the benefit of your own country and anything that that country was doing, and also for diplomatic relations. But we were eyes and ears for our country, and so therefore you were always being watched by their country, especially in an Iron Curtain country when we were so-called enemies. And I had a wonderful living quarters, a magnificent apartment in Budapest. We were very restricted because it was communist, and we were always being watched. But at the same time, even though we led a kind of insular life, but it was still socially very active, and we mingled with all the other embassies that were there and all the personnel. So there was one party after another, one trip after another. We had our own baseball team, and we just had our own life. And one day, there was an international incident regarding the fact that the Hungarians were taking over all of American interests in that country, and because they needed all kinds of excuses to do this, they really didn't. They did it anyway, but they wanted it to look good, so they would always take, let's say, a businessman that was on, and it was very hard to get into that country, but you big businessmen could. So in that country we had AT&T, head of AT&T, his name was Robert Vogler. They always would report into the embassy, let us know where they were and how and what they were doing so that we could keep track of every American there. And this man was the Hungarian government wanted to take over AT&T there. So Robert Vogler, the businessman, was picked up off the streets, arrested as being a spy. And that started a whole international incident with the trial. And at that time, I was named in the trial as being part of his network. And realizing that I had to get out fast, he was in jail. They had arrested his Hungarian friends. Many were executed. It was very dangerous. The diplomatic world and the business world were very involved in trying to get him out. They used him as a scapegoat. I was told that I wasn't too safe, and so in a hurry, in a very big hurry, I was sent out of the country to Vienna, which is right over the border, where I used to go on weekends anyway, so I was very familiar with Vienna, and I was quite happy to be there, and glad to get out, and was billeted or housed at the Regina Hotel in Vienna, and settled in nicely, had a nice room, lovely hotel, dining room, a nice circle of friends, and I worked for counterintelligence corps in Vienna, doing, sort of editing intelligence reports, putting them in their proper forms, etc., and had a very active life, traveled a lot, terrific social life, had many trips outside of Vienna, both business and pleasure. And let me stop and thank you. One thing I did forget to tell you, Harold, about when I was in Budapest, I really loved sculpture. That was my favorite form of art. And I had had a painting done by a fine painter by the name of Ostalos. But I wanted to see the studios of Sigmund Strobel, who lived in Budapest, and was a world-famous sculptor who had done all the kings and queens and heads of state in the world, literally. And he had actually been to San Simeon helping Hearst at one time with the fountain. But anyway, he was stuck in Budapest, labeled bourgeoisie and only allowed to do big monuments for the Russians. So he was cut off really from the Western world. But one day I went over to just glance through his studios, and I was in awe with all the original casts of, at that time, Queen Elizabeth and whatnot. And as I was oohing and aahing, this little old man came up to me and said he would like to do me, and he shook his hand. He shook my hand. He said, "I am Sigmund Strobel, and I'd love to." And I said to him, "Oh my God, I can't afford your prices. You know, they used to start at $10,000. That in those days, when before he was to do a bust of someone." So he said, no, you just pay for the materials." So, and he said, "Be careful about coming and going, because every once in a while they come in and investigate my studios to see if I'm doing anything illegal." So he said, "I just want someone to talk to from the West." Mm-hmm. And we had a wonderful friendship. I'd sit for a session while he sculpted my head. I was not an easy subject because my features are very regular. I had no outstanding features. I didn't have a big nose. I didn't have huge or cross eyes or anything to really exaggerate. So it was a regular. You look at the bust today, which is in bronze, and he chose the media. It doesn't even look like me because it's so ordinary, but it's done by this unbelievable artist and who later became a very good friend of mine. And I was able, when I went to Vienna, I was able to get medicine for his wife, which he couldn't get in Budapest, and also send letters to George Bernard Shaw for him, which was what I wanted to tell you about. And I would just take them out with me and mail them. And they were very harmless letters, but they were friendly. But he was still corresponding with the West, and he wasn't allowed to. I did have an incident there when he got a warning that Rákosi, who was the head of state in Budapest, in Hungary, was coming to pay him a visit with his entourage. And so he got the call, and he told me I better get out fast so he wouldn't get caught with a Westerner and I wouldn't be in trouble for doing this terrible thing, sitting for a portrait of some sort. Anyway, that's what I wanted to tell you about, one of the highlights in Budapest. And then I'm off to Vienna, staying at the Regina Hotel, and having... I was working then for Counterintelligence Corps in the operations department, going through all kinds of reports and putting them in order, etc., reading and reports, and had a very interesting job with a wonderful staff of people, and my social life there also was interesting. I had a very good friend, Galia McGonigal, who was the chief translator for the quadripartite meetings, in which she would be the assistant to our commanding general in Vienna and go to the monthly meetings and do the translation from the Russian to the English for him, from the French to the English for him, And he didn't have he didn't need a British translator, but she was a very, very vital person, very good friend of mine, who actually invited me to one of these meetings, and I was allowed to sit with them at the table and watch the process, which I thought was fascinating, because, you know, in Vienna, it was under the four-power control, and every month a different country would take control of the international, that is the center section of Vienna, commonly known as where the soccer hotel was, where the big hotels were. And it was that's where Four Men in a Jeep came from, because all the major powers had to be represented. And 1 month it was under American control, 1 month Russian, 1 month French, 1 month English. But they would have the monthly meetings of all the commanders, and Gallia would do the translating, and I was a guest of hers, and these were the real perks of traveling abroad and working for the government at that time, being really in on all the history-making things that were going on. But anyway, she had a Christmas Eve party. I was dating several people, but one in particular was an agent, intelligence agent, I'd become very friendly with, and we were having a lot of dates, and we went to was it Christmas Eve? Okay, Gallia was the only American that was allowed to live outside of the American sector. She lived in the British sector, and she had a home there because of her status. And most of her friends were British, and she had all kinds of parties and both diplomatic and otherwise. And she had a bridge club circle with the British, and one of her bridge partners or friends was a young captain by the name of Gerald Arnold Nemeth. He was a physician for the British Armed Forces and stationed in Vienna at Schönbrunn Palace. And Gallia had a Christmas Eve party, and it was in 1951. She had a Christmas Eve party, and she wanted me to come, and I was going to with this young man who was an agent, and we had both had these party offers, and I was supposed to go with him to his, and he was supposed to go with me to mine, and we had a problem with getting to two different places at one time, so I suggested that he go to his and I go to mine, because I was going to stay overnight at Gallia's that night, and it was fine. And so when I went to this party with her at her home, she had all British people, mostly people at the embassy, and then there was this young man with curly hair in a civilian outfit. His name was Gerald Arnold Nemeth, and he was part of her bridge group. And we were having a lovely evening, the whole evening. I didn't talk to him because he was busy and I was busy. And towards the end of the evening, after dinner, he came over and we started to talk to with each other. And he had asked me for a date. And I said to him, I made an excuse about why I couldn't go. And he asked me for my number, but I gave it to him. And so when he called the next day, he wanted me to go out for New Year's Eve. And I said, well, I'm going to go to Heidelberg, Germany, where my girlfriend was having a big party for New Year's. And I would talk to him in a few weeks or so. And in the meantime, my girlfriend broke her leg and canceled her party. And Gerald had called me to wish me a Happy New Year before I left. And at that time, I said, I told him I wasn't going, and he said, well, will you come to my party? And I said, he said it was at the Park Hotel where he was living, which is a British hotel. So I thought, well, what was he doing at the Park Hotel now? He was in civilian clothes when I met him. And I said, well, call me later. And my hesitation was because I thought he was a kid. He had these curly hair, these curly locks over his face. He was wearing civilian clothes. He looked like a teenager. And when my friend Galia called and said, how come you didn't go with Jerry called me and said that he asked you out and you didn't go, and what's the deal? He was really so cute. And I said, Gaddy, I'm not going to go with a teenager. I thought he was a British dependent with his family, that his father was an officer and he was with his family in Vienna. And I also had been going to school at night at the University of Vienna. I was trying to learn some. I was taking a class actually in Shakespeare and in German, which I never really learned. And I thought he looked like a typical student to me. And she said, what are you talking about, Louise? He's a nice Jewish doctor. So I said, oh, you're kidding. He couldn't be old enough to be a doctor. He's a captain in the army. I said he was wearing... at that time, I could recognize every rank of every country. But he wasn't wearing a uniform. If he was wearing a uniform, I would have known that he was a captain and that he'd have to have been a certain age. And he also would have had a caduceus on the... on the uniform, which would have designated what he was, his specialty. So I said, oh, well, that's different. Maybe I ought to think about it. And so when he called me again, I said, sure, I'll go. You know, it was a formal party, a New Year's Eve party at the Park Hotel, which many years ago, which not too many years ago, we revisited. But it was so funny because his car got stuck in the snow. It was snowing, and he had to take a public transportation, which was a streetcar, to my hotel. It was the only thing that was running, and here he was in formal attire, and I was in formal attire, and we got on a streetcar to go to his party at the Park Hotel, which was a lot of fun, and he got me a ride back to my hotel with somebody who had the chains on their tires, I remember distinctly. And we started a very, very nice friendship. We went to operas, dinners, different parties. There was no romance at all. Didn't seem to be any chemistry on my part. And he was very, very gentlemanly and very careful, and he did not indicate more interest than what I would allow him to indicate. But I didn't know how he knew I was Jewish. I knew he was. But what happened later on is that he told me I had a very large room at the hotel, and I had a bookshelves. And he said that I knew you were Jewish the first time I took you out and went in your room and saw that you had The Wall by John Hersey, which was a book about the Jews and the Holocaust, etc. And he said no Gentile would have had a book like that on their shelf. And that's when he knew I was Jewish, and he began to sort of pursue me then. And we had a very wonderful friendship, and my contract was over. I didn't want to renew it. His tour of duty was over, and around the same time, again, same kind of history I had like in Japan, but this was different. I really had a deep, deep friendship with Jerry, and it wasn't until he did something so beautiful that I really fell in love, and on the spur of the moment, he came over to help me pack. to go home. I started packing about a month before I left, and came over to help me pack. And we had dinner, and he came back to my room, and he was packing. I was packing my shoes in one big case and whatnot, and he pulled out a pair of my shoes, and he said, "No, you can't pack these. They're too dusty." And he sat on the floor, took out his handkerchief, and started to clean my shoes for me. And even now, I get very emotional. So I became very moved by this beautiful, humble gesture. And I actually, at that moment, said to myself, "My God, how could I think of never seeing this person again? He's the most beautiful human being. You know, he's helping me pack. I know he's in love with me, and he doesn't push anything, and he's helping, and he's on the floor cleaning my shoes." And I suddenly was really in love. And from then on, the last month that I was in Vienna, I was definitely open to his feelings and emotions, and we really had from then on a very, very close personal relationship, which resulted in his proposal. And then we made plans that I would go back, and he would I would go to England before I went home. He had to leave early, a few weeks before I did. And that I would go before I went back to the States. I would go to England, visit his family, and get to meet them. And then I would go home to the States and then come back. We'd plan our wedding, which is exactly what I did. I went to London and England, Newcastle, before I went back to the States, and met his family, met Lucille and Cyril. Went up to Newcastle to meet his parents, had a wonderful visit with them, very, very wonderful parents. And then we made our plans to get married. I went back to the States, and we, by mail, he was going to do all the spade work as far as just finding out where we would get married make all the arrangements, because we were going to get married in London, since he had started his residency in psychiatry. So we had to get married there. So he started to make the plans, and we kept in touch mostly by letter, which we wrote almost every day. Once in a while, he would send a telegram, and made our plans. I went back to England. London, stayed with my cousin Leah and her husband in Goldie's Green, around the corner from where Lucille lived and her family, and we finished our plans and got married. Okay, we got married at Selby Hotel, which is a kosher hotel in London. We took a bed sitting room in the West End because I had got a job with the American Embassy based on the fact that I got the job before I got married. I went in for the interview, and they hired me because I had a top secret clearance, and they needed someone at the time and were sending to the States for someone, but here I was with all the qualifications, and they hired me. But I told the personnel manager I was going to get married to a British person, and that was against the law, because if you're doing sensitive material and you are married to a person of that country, there's always a question as to where your loyalty would lie. Therefore, it was illegal for me to be married to a local person while working in a top secret area, and yet they couldn't hire me for a non-classified job, because the law was they had to hire local people for that. So the beauty of it is that the employment person said, "Look, you're not married yet. I'll hire you as Louise Ross. When you get married, you report your marriage, and by the time your papers get to the States and they find out about it, I'll let you know and you can quit. Therefore, you'll have at least a couple of months of employment. And so we lived in London because I had to be near my work, and Jerry used to drive to Coulston where he was finishing his embarking on his residency in psychiatry. And this happened. It was wonderful. I had a wonderful job at the embassy and was making 10 times more than the average Britisher, and had all the advantages of the PX buying things that were rationed on the market. So we had I was able to buy things for everybody, Jerry's family. I got eggs and butter and all these things that you couldn't get on the economy. And then that happened that my marriage had to be reported. By the time the papers came back and I was told by the officer they were on their way, I quit as per our arrangement. And that's when Jerry and I moved to the suburbs closer to his hospital, where he was going to finish his residency in Sutton, Surrey. We had a little a flat that was like three different stories high, and which we also had in London, in Belgravia. But then we moved to the old place in Sutton. I became very good friends. We both became very good friends with our landlord and lady, the Perloffs. Became part of Sutton Jewish community, head of his hospital. We were very, very close with, and had a wonderful but sparse, economically sparse life, but it didn't matter when we were young. And Valerie was actually born while we were in Sutton in 1954, March. And that's when we had started our plans to come, as we arranged before we were married. He was going to give it a try in the States, because the best psychiatric and institutes were in the States, and Beverly Hills, and he thought he would come give it a try. And so we came out here. He had to do an internship all over again before he could take his medical boards in this country, which was the law. So it set us back a couple of years. He did an internship at Queen of Angels, and Valerie was little and she wasn't well, so I couldn't work. But my family were great help to me, and Valerie had the asthma and needed a great deal of care. And Jerry got through his internship at the Queen of Angels, where we made some very dear lifelong friends. One in particular were the Grandins, Pierre and Pierrette Grandin and their family, who later we visited in during Expo 67 in Canada. And then he finished his internship, had to take his... when we first came to the States, we stayed with my sister Millie and Art, who had a house in Beverly Hills, until he got into his internship, which was quite a few months later. And we had a wonderful stay with them. They were marvelous to us. We'll never forget it. And their two kids, they had Sandy and Robin, Robin was Valerie's age, so it worked out beautifully. And then we were able to get our own flat near the hospital for his internship, then later moved to the suburbs, Compton actually, where he took a residency in psychiatry. And since he wasn't an American citizen yet, he couldn't get into the... Veterans Administration to work, but he did as soon as he got his citizenship. He was able to get a post and finish his residency at the Veterans Hospital. As an intern in a Catholic hospital, he was. We were very good friends with the chief nun, Sister Digna. Was very good to us, and she recognized Jerry's talents and his brilliance, and what a waste it was to put him into the as an intern giving IVs. So she put him in the psychiatric section. So his residency, his internship was very, very much up his line. He did just psychiatric work there, and. I'm skipping back and forth here. I'm trying to think of after his residency, and I had Pam was born while we lived in Compton, and that at that time, while I was in the hospital right after I had Pam, which was at. Hospital Queen of Angels, where Jerry did his internship. Jerry told me that he had been accepted in the institute to train for psychoanalysis, and so then we decided. But he was also doing was accepted as a resident at Veterans Hospital. So we moved into town. We rented a house on Midvale in West LA. And eventually bought a house on Thayer Avenue, which is our first home that we owned, having lived there for 10 years, and he had started a practice in Beverly Hills in psychiatry, in psychoanalysis on the side as he was in training. He took on private patients in psychiatry. And the twins were born, Stephen and Stephanie were born while we lived on Midvale, before we moved to Thayer. And, of course, we recognized the need for a bigger place right away. And that's when we bought the house on Thayer and enlarged it as much as we could. And after 10 years, Jerry said, look, we can't have tandem rooms here. The twins had to have separate rooms. We had them together. And we had really tacked on another room, but it wasn't satisfactory because we had live-in help. So we looked and found that's when we got, we were living on Thayer then, and that was getting crowded. So Jerry found this house on Dalehurst over 20 years ago. And said to me, and I happened to have gotten very attached to the neighborhood and there, and my neighbors, the Lynns, the kids were comfortable, and I hated to leave it, but he felt the need to for more space, and he was teaching at UCLA anyway, and so he looked around Westwood and found this house, came home one day and said, if you like it, we're getting it. And I said, okay. I went to look at it, and I thought, oh, it was so terribly high-priced. I said, so we made him a bottom offer, which we were shocked that they accepted. And then before we moved here, the house was empty. We gave a great big party because Jerry's brother and his father were coming out on a visit. And so the house was empty, and we had something like 220 people here at a big reception for them. Nobody knew we hadn't moved in. There were so many people here. Couldn't have seen the furniture anyway. Now, well, my mother was a very bright, short, pretty red-haired, a carrot red-haired lady who loved classical music. But as she was the, I think she was the middle child. She had an older brother, I think she was the number one child, and then she had a brother, and then a younger sister who died when she was young from a heart problem. She was 19. She had, like, a rheumatic heart problem. She died young. My mother was a short, very pretty, very pale-skinned woman who was extremely devoted to the family. She was always cooking and always cleaning and always worrying about us. And that's a kind of, I guess, typical for, who knows? But, I mean, I thought typical, but I think we were very lucky to have such a devoted, wonderful mother. My father was a 6 foot tall, extremely handsome, blue-eyed man who was athletic and fun-loving, very funny, always trying to work, and he had 7 kids to support. So it was quite a responsibility. And ask me some questions, Harold.
Well, given that he probably might have had more than one job at various points and worked long hours, was he always there? Was he not around that much? Or?
Oh no, he was home all the time, except that when he took jobs, like when I was a little older, and he started to go to San Diego for his work, because he started a kind of a business for the blind. Really, he was, I think, one of the originators of the industry's blind industry products, where he, a lot of his very dear friends were, didn't have a lot, but he had a very dear friend who was blind and very handy, and he conceived the idea of selling the products that were made by the blind. And one of the first industries he started, though nothing, it never worked to his advantage, because other people who were more, I think, business-minded benefited from it. But he was at that time working in San Diego and coming home on weekends when I was getting older. But when I was growing up, he was always home, always working at one thing or another. And I'm not that specific. I think my older sisters and brothers, and my older brother would know more about it. Because I was a middle kid, and I just never really was involved that much with those things.